Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Christopher Gribben, adjunct lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. This is episode CCXLIX, Viriathus. Viriathus was a Lestanian leader who rose from humble beginnings to become one of Rome's most formidable enemies. A skilled tactician and master of guerrilla warfare, he led his people in resistance against the Roman expansion in Hispania during the 2nd century BCE. Celebrated for his honour and leadership, even by the Romans who fought him, Viriathus' story is one of resilience, betrayal, and the enduring struggle for freedom against the empire. Here's Christopher Gribben.
Viriathus was a leader of a native tribe called the Lusitani, and he was their leader between 147 and 139 BC. The Lusitani were people that were located in what is today central Portugal and sort of central western Spain, so that part of the Iberian Peninsula.
Okay, and in context at the time, what are we talking about? A collection of tribes? Was it its own little empire?
So the Iberian Peninsula has a really complex history. In the first millennium BC, it's settled by Phoenicians along the coastal areas along the south and the east. It's settled by Greeks up in what is the northeast of Spain today. There are a large number of independent tribes within the central part of Spain and Portugal throughout that period. The Carthaginians really start to expand into that territory in the 3rd century BC. So after the First Punic War, the Carthaginians lose Sicily and lose Sardinia and decide to make up for it by conquering Spain. So they take over not the whole of the Iberian Peninsula, but a big chunk of it. And then when the Second Punic War happens and the Romans are fighting the Carthaginians, the Romans push the Carthaginians out of Spain, and then they decide, hey, this place is quite nice, it's got some useful resources, so why don't we stay here? So they end up creating two provinces, Hispania Citerior and Hispania Ulterior. That's closer Spain and further Spain, basically. Those provinces, they don't take up much of the Iberian Peninsula, so they're really located to areas that are relatively close to the coast. So Hispania Citerior is basically along the eastern coast of Spain today, and Hispania Ulterior is along the southern coast. The rest of the peninsula is left alone to do its own thing, but not for very long. Pretty quickly after the Romans established those provinces in 197 BC, you find that there's various conflicts happening between the Romans and the different tribes that are living further inland. Either those tribes are coming in and raiding Roman territory, or the Romans are going on expeditions into conquering their territory and bringing them under Roman control. And this actually goes on for about 200 years. It's not until 19 BC that the whole of the Iberian Peninsula is under Roman control. It's sort of a really gradual process starting from between 197 or really 206 is when they asked the Carthaginians. A gradual process happening over the next couple of hundred years.
So in this context then, who was Viriathus?
So Viriathus is somebody that comes to be a leader of one of the groups of native Spanish people, the Lusitani. There's a whole number of skirmishes that happen one way or the other between the Lusitani and the Romans from pretty soon after the Romans arrive on the scene. Viriathus comes into a leadership position during one of those wars in 147 BC.
So what can you tell me about the conflicts? Was this a gradual push west for the Romans?
It's really hard to know is the short of it. We don't have a lot of details about this. Certainly from the Roman perspective, it's not their fault. Diodorus Siculus, he tells us that the Lusitani are particularly warlike and they like to come and raid Roman territory. He tells us that a peculiar practice obtains among the Iberians, and particularly amongst the Lusitanians, that's the Lusitani, for when their young men come to the bloom of their physical strength, those who are very poorest among them in worldly goods, and yet excel in vigour of body and daring, equip themselves with no more than valour and arms, and gather in the mountain fastness, where they form into bands of considerable size, and then descend upon Iberia and collect wealth from their pillaging. And this brigandage they continually practice in a spirit of complete disdain, For using as they do light arms and being altogether nimble and swift, they are most difficult people for other men to subdue. And speaking generally, they consider the fastness and crags of the mountains to be their native land, and to these places, which large and heavily equipped armies find hard to traverse, they flee for refuge. Consequently, although the Romans in their frequent campaigns against the Lusitanians rid them of their great spirit of disdain, they were nevertheless unable, often as they eagerly set about it, to put a complete end to their plundering.
This doesn't sound like a warring faction or a well thought out enemy incursion or anything like that. It sounds like bored youths.
That's certainly the way that this is being portrayed. Now, when we have a look at events that happen a little bit later, the war that Viriathus is involved with, we have stories of tens of thousands of people. It's a much more orderly sort of activity. But we do see over and over again this kind of guerrilla tactic being used within the wars between the Lusitani and the Romans, where they're using their lightly armed troops on fast horses to come and harass the Romans, then retreat. The Romans will follow them and then they will surround them. They'll jump out from the forests to attack them when they least expect it. They use their knowledge of the terrain to trap Romans between the army and a cliff and things like that. So that seems to be a sort of recurrent theme that we see in a lot of the description of these wars, is the Lusitani being less the sort of traditional Roman style of fighting, of getting a large army and getting them to stand in a line on a field and then get the other army in a line on the other side of the field and then sort of march at each other.
Yeah.
Much more of this kind of hit and run guerrilla tactic. I would take it all with a bit of a grain of salt. If you look at Roman history, it's never their fault. There's always somebody else that's attacking them. There's always somebody else who's breaking their treaties or breaking their agreements or who's raiding them or who's doing something. It's these barbarians who don't know how to be civilized that are the cause of everything. So I don't know that that's always true. It may be a bit of bias on the part of our authors there.
Yeah. So when does this become a war then?
The war between the Lusitani and the Romans starts in 155 or 154 BC. So that's when we know that there was an incursion of the Lusitani into Roman territory down in the, what is today the south of Spain, so Hispania Ulterior. And we are told that the Lusitani invade and ravaged the fields of the Roman subjects, killed 6,000 Romans, including one of the officials from the Roman administration as well. So that seems to be what really kicks off hostilities in a major way.
Yeah, the Romans aren't going to stand for that sort of thing.
No, they now have to take some action and they are very happy to take some action at this point.
Yeah.
Doesn't go well in the beginning. The first person that they send over to really deal with it is a guy by the name of Mummius. He attacks, but he's defeated in battle by the Lusitani and they steal the standards. And then they take the standards and they parade them around the Iberia saying, hey, look, everybody, we've got a whole bunch of Roman standards,
wow.
Which the Romans also don't particularly take kindly to. They do get them back pretty soon afterwards, but that's a real kind of insult to the Romans. And it's one of the things that is, I think, really interesting about this is that the Romans seem to be pretty equally matched to the Lusitani in battle.
Mm. How does this progress? Because I imagine that there's a lot going on for the Roman Empire at the time.
I don't think it's their number one priority, let's put it that way, but it's certainly something that they need to deal with. So Hispania Ulterior, the Roman province, had a lot of mining in it, so it was a very useful area to have and to have control of. It also sees quite a few Roman settlers moving over there as well. So there are Roman colonies that are established in the second century. So it's not something that the Romans can ignore.
Mm. So the Romans are met with this resistance. There's been an initial defeat. There's been a bit of humiliation. So what's the next step up of the campaign?
So in 151 BC, the Romans send over two new governors, Lucius Licinius Lucullus and Servius Sulpicius Galba. They're the governors of Hispania Citeria and Hispania Ulterior. And together they make a coordinated attack on the Lusitani, attacking from two different sides in a kind of pincer movement. The Lusitani, they realize that there's no way that they can win this. So they try to make a peace settlement with Galba.
Mm.
And then Galba decides to completely betray them, essentially. He receives them very favorably. He says, yeah, come on board. We'll make a truce. He's supposedly sympathetic to the Lusitani. Of course, he says, this is according to Appian, poorness of soil and penury forced you to do these things. But if you wish to be friendly, I will give you good land for your poor people and settle them in three divisions in a fertile country. So he convinces them essentially with this promise of giving them good land that to surrender. So they come in at a particular appointed time. And then what we're told, Appian tells us that Golba divided them into three parts, and showing to each division a certain plain, he commanded them to remain in this open country until he should assign them their places. Then he came to the first division and told them that, as friends, to lay down their arms. When they'd done so, he surrounded them with a ditch and sent in soldiers with swords who slew them all.
Whoa.
They, meanwhile, crying aloud and invoking the names and faith of the gods, in like manner he hastened to the second and third divisions and destroyed them while they were still ignorant of the fate of the first. So that's the version that we get in Appian. Livy's different version is that they were all captured and sold into slavery.
That's
so still not a great version.
That's still not good.
No, that's what Golba does. Apparently, a few of them managed to escape. One of them is Viriathus, so about to pop into our story essentially at this point.
Yeah.
But most of the Lusitani are either, well, a large portion of their force is either killed or sold into slavery, so they are eliminated in this way.
That's really surprising. I mean, you know, going in with your soldiers, attacking and having a good honourable war is one thing. This is using deception.
Yeah, and it wasn't acceptable to the Romans either. When Golba came back to Rome after having done his stint as the governor, we're told that he was in fact brought up on charges for it. But Appian gives us this very brief description of what happened, which is that Golba escaped punishment by means of his wealth.
How Roman.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is some distant relative of famous Golba.
200 years later,
yeah,
one of his family members becomes Emperor Golba.
Wow. What pedigree.
Yeah.
No matter how you paint that picture, that is a defeat for the Lusitanians.
Yes.
But you foreshadowed that Viriathus was on scene for this and was one of the ones who escaped.
That's right. Nothing seems to happen for 4 years. I guess the Lusitani are recovering from
what
happened.
Yeah.
In 147 BC, what happens is that 10,000 Lusitani and maybe some of their allies decide to launch another attack onto the Romans. And this doesn't actually go very well for the Lusitani. They get trapped by the Romans. The leaders send some envoys off to the Romans to try to organize peace terms. And what we're told is that then one of the soldiers there, who happens to be Viriathus, stands up and says, actually, you remember these guys aren't very trustworthy, and says, look, I know it looks like we're trapped, but I've got a plan to get us out of here. And if you make me a leader, I can sort everything out for us.
Okay.
And they say, that sounds like a good plan. Let's do that.
Right. He sounds like he's a Lusitanian with experience, both in what can go wrong and how to fight, I guess. So is this the start of his myth building?
Yeah, and this is where the legends really start. So one of the things that I think is really interesting about Viriathus is that he develops this kind of legendary figure where he has all these wonderful attributes that are given to him by all of the authors that we have.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm a little bit skeptical about some of these aspects, but I think they're an interesting part of the story. So Diodorus Siculus, for example, he tells us that Viriathus was one of the inhabitants of the sea coasts, a shepherd upon the mountains from his childhood, by nature of a healthy constitution, in strength and ability of body far exceeding all the Iberians. For he had inured himself to a sparing diet, much labour and toil, and to no more sleep than was absolutely necessary. He always carried weapons and was famous for his conflicts, both with wild beasts and robbers. And Cassius Dio tells us that Viriathus possessed such a physique as the result of both nature and training. He excelled still more in his mental powers. He was swift to plan and accomplish whatever was needful, for he not only knew what must be done, but also understood the proper occasion for it. And there's a whole lot more of that. They go on and on and on with all of these superb qualities that Viriathus supposedly has that make him this sort of superman of men.
It sounds very grounded.
Hmm.
you know, there was nothing fantastical in there that I say isn't possible. So
it's all quite possible, yeah. But it's a universally good picture, I think, of his character. We have this great story of here he is, he's a humble shepherd that rises up through dint of his great physique and prowess as a fighter and his mental capacity. He's given the leadership of the Lusitani. Certainly some historians have questioned whether that's a particularly realistic story. It's a nice story. It's a great story. It makes for a great movie. But whether that's a realistic story or whether it's more likely that, in fact, he was a noble in the first place, that one suggestion has been that maybe he was a person who owned a lot of sheep as a noble rather than necessarily being a lowly shepherd.
Yes.
That's what our sources tell us. Everything else is speculation, but it's a surprise to find that this kind of humble shepherd standing up in the middle and suddenly being elected the general of the army.
Mm. All right. So he's got an army now. He's the leader, but the Lusitanians are captured.
Yeah. The Lusitani is surrounded by the Roman forces and Viriathus has this plan. Basically what he gets his troops to do is to all come out from the place where they're hauled up, to line up in the field as if they're going to embark into a regular battle with the Romans. But he has a secret order to them, which is that as soon as he gets onto his horse, everybody except for 1,000 men are all going to disappear off into different directions. And then they're all going to later meet up at the town of Tribola. Exactly this happens. The Romans line up their army. Viriathus lines up his army with Lusitani. Viriathus jumps up on his horse. They all scatter into different directions except for 1,000 soldiers that Viriathus has asked to stay behind. The Romans don't know what to do with this. They can't chase everybody in every direction, so they decide to attack the 1,000 men that are with Viriathus. And what they do then is, again, this kind of guerrilla tactic where they're on these fast horses, they're lightly armed, so they come in, they attack the Romans, and then they run away again.
Okay.
And then they come back and attack the Romans and run away again and come back. And this keeps the Roman army really busy. It keeps them stuck, essentially, in that one place while the rest of the Lusitani escape. And then when they've had enough of that, Viriathus and his men escape as well.
That doesn't sound like it's a satisfying fight for the Romans.
No.
It sounds very tedious.
It's very tedious. And we're told, in fact, that the Romans have a force of about 10,000 soldiers and 4,000 of them are either killed or taken prisoner during this process. So he's really just picking them off bit by bit using his faster abilities on the horse.
This doesn't sound like it's going to achieve anything in the long run. It sounds like a good way and an effective way to escape, which you don't think a general would want to do. It's not engaging in battle. It's not solving the problem. And it's really annoying your enemy.
Yeah. It's not a definitive victory for the Lusitani in any way.
Mm.
But what it does do is it gives Viriathus a lot of credibility. And then what happens after that is that he gains a lot of fame amongst the other Spanish and Portuguese tribes in the area, and a lot of them decide to join up with him. So he manages, he's escaped, his army regroups at Tribola. They're able to be joined by other people, and then he's able to start his proper campaign.
Mm-hmm. Now that he's got the confidence, I guess, of the Lusitanians, what does regrouping and providing a credible resistance look like to Viriathus?
What it looks like is traveling around Spain plundering.
Wow.
So that's his next step. These group of people, we're told that he required the owners of growing crops to pay him the value thereof, or if they would not, he destroyed them. That's how Appian describes it. Florus describes it, that he laid waste with fire and sword all of the land on both sides of the Iberus and Tagus, so major rivers in Spain.
These are Roman sources, though. I'm not trying to defend Viriathus, but these are Roman sources.
Absolutely. And he's certainly launching a campaign. There's a bit of confusion about exactly where he goes. Some of our sources suggest that he heads up north, and other ones suggest that he heads down south. And that's entirely clear from the sources that we have. The consensus seems to be that he's moving around plundering, at least partially. Exactly the details of that are hard to know. But it might be that he's only plundering those cities or communities that don't accept his leadership.
Yeah.
It may be it is attacking things that are strategically allied with the Romans.
Yeah, yeah. And the Romans at least would want to deal with this situation because they don't want a unified force, I guess, to come up against, really.
Yeah, and I mean, he's clearly causing trouble for them in one way or another. Whatever these raids involve, they're clearly not good. So the Romans keep sending forces against him. A number of them are defeated. They don't actually have a victory until 145. So there's 2 years, essentially, of Viriathus wandering around doing what he likes. They seem to have a relatively minor victory in 145 under Caius Laelius. And then the Romans decide they've really got to take this a bit more seriously. And 145, they send over Fabius Maximus Aemilianus, who is the adopted son of Aemilius Paulus, who defeated the Macedonians. And he builds up a force of 15,000 soldiers and 2,000 cavalry.
Mm.
He's also very cautious about engaging with Viriathus. He's not sort of jumping into it. He spends a long time training his forces, getting them ready, and doesn't actually attack Viriathus till 144 BC. So he builds up his forces, he gets it strong, gets them well trained, gets them ready to go, and that's when he attacks. And in this case, he actually manages to push Viriathus back into a stronghold called Venus Mountain, where Viriathus holds up there, and then Viriathus has to think up a slightly different tactic. What he does is he sends out some messengers and incites several other tribes to attack, particularly up in Hispania Citeria. So he's down more towards Hispania Ulterior, but he's getting the tribes to attack another part of Spain, essentially, so that keeps some of the Roman forces occupied dealing with that. Mm. And that ends up starting the Numantine War, which is a whole other story. And that war goes then for another 11 years till 133 BC. So that's another major conflict that the Romans are suddenly involved in, thanks to Viriathus here, where he's hauled up there.
Is there any point that the Romans kind of think, okay, maybe sending wave after wave of troops against Viriathus isn't going to achieve anything?
Eventually what happens, Aemilianus has had his victory in 144 BC, but Viriathus and the Lusitani have managed to break free from that. They go back to a whole series of conflicts that are happening until eventually Aemilianus's son gets sent over as the governor in 142. That's Fabius Maximus Servilianus. They have some more conflict until eventually in 140 BC, Viriathus manages to trap the Romans. And he decides to send out some envoys, and he and Suilianus actually make a peace treaty at this point.
An actual peace treaty, not a Galba treaty.
Not a Galba treaty, a genuine peace treaty. Viriathus is declared a friend of the Roman people.
Wow.
And he is allowed to keep all of the land that his forces occupy.
Yeah.
And this is sent back to Rome, and it is agreed to by the Senate in Rome. So this actually is officially an end to the hostilities.
You know that you've made a lot of trouble for the Romans when they take a step back like that and agree to those sort of terms.
They clearly decided that this is not worth pursuing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And presumably the part of the thinking is that they are just sending force after force, not really achieving anything.
Mm.
So if they can reach a peace treaty, that's going to be a better deal, essentially, for the Romans.
But if I understand it correctly, how you said it is, it's Viriathus who forces this.
That's right, yeah. Suilianus is trapped, and this is basically, you can have a peace treaty or we can massacre you. Those are
your options. Wow.
But what's more interesting, perhaps, is the fact that the Roman Senate agrees to this, because certainly the Senate at other times, when people have sent back peace treaties, has said, no, we don't agree with this peace treaty.
Yeah.
You need to keep fighting.
Yes, yeah.
And this time they don't.
Wow, I'm stunned by how much he achieves, honestly, considering the way this could have gone. So if he was coming from a position of power in this situation, why did he go for peace? It seems very uncharacteristic for what we know about him so far.
Yeah, well, Appian tells us that it's because he was not arrogant in the hour of victory, but considering this a favourable opportunity to bring the war to an end and win the great gratitude of the Romans. But it's also been suggested that his forces may be running a bit low at this point.
Mm.
And it's certainly one of the things from his perspective. The Romans keep sending new forces against him. And they keep coming. Every time he defeats one of them, they send a new one. And then he defeats another one and they send a new one. He probably does not have this, or he definitely would not have had the same access to manpower to continually replenish his forces. So even though he's winning the battles, each of them, he would be losing some. So you have very much a similar situation to what happens with Pyrrhus, where, yeah, he's victorious, but his force gets smaller every time.
Mm.
Whereas the Romans can just get new forces to replace them.
Yeah.
So probably a treaty that makes sense for both sides at that point in time.
So at what point does it not make sense? It sounds like quite quickly.
Yeah, within a year.
Okay, yeah.
What happens is that Servilianus goes back to Rome.
Good treaty.
And he's replaced by his brother, Quintus Servilius Caepio. And Caepio comes along and straight away he's like, no, this treaty's garbage. It's unworthy of the dignity of the Roman people, according to him. And he starts sending a whole lot of letters back to the Roman Senate to saying, no, we can't have this treaty. These people need to be fought and defeated. This is, you know, unbecoming to the honor of Rome, and we need to reopen hostilities. What happens is that the Senate agrees to that. Then Caepio gets together with the governor of Hispania Citeria. So Caepio is the governor of Hispania Ulterior.
Yeah.
And again, they do the same trick of creating a pincer movement to attack Viriathus from two sides and to trap him. 139 BC, now the tables have turned. Viriathus has been trapped by the Roman forces and he is now seeking a peace treaty with them.
He tried this before, but now he's coming at it from a position of inferiority.
Yeah, now he's in the much worse position. That's right. It's a different sort of story. It doesn't go quite the way that he's expecting, though. He sends his three most trusted friends to negotiate with Caepio. Well, actually, first of all, he tries to negotiate with the other governor, Popilius. Popilius says, I'm only going to give you a peace treaty if you surrender all of your arms. And he goes, well, I'm not doing that. That's not, he saw what happened last time that they tried that. So he's not going to do that. So he then sends his three trusted friends to negotiate with Caepio. We've got two different versions of it. Either Caepio bribes his friends to say, well, I will give you a whole lot of riches if you kill Viriathus.
Mm.
That's the version we have in Appian, or the version that we have in Diodorus Siculus is that they initiated things, that they could see that Viriathus was in a weak position and they thought the best way to save themselves would be to try and do a deal with Caepio. Either way, what happens is that these three friends and Caepio reach some sort of agreement where they're going to kill Viriathus. They go back to the camp. They go into his tent at night while he's asleep and stab him.
Right.
And that's the end of Viriathus.
Wow. And then when the army wakes up in the morning, they realize that their general is dead. So what was the Lusitanian reaction then to their general dying?
So we're told that the Lusitani put on a grand funeral for him. Appian tells us that they arrayed the body of Viriathus in splendid garments and burned it on a lofty funeral pyre. Many sacrifices were offered for him. Troops of horse and foot in armor marched around him, singing his praises in barbarian fashion. Nor did they depart from the funeral pyre until the fire had gone out. And when the obsequies were ended, they had gladiatorial contests at his tomb. They recognize him as a great leader. It's a great loss for them, and they mourn him accordingly.
I notice how, you know, that uses the word barbarian fashion. If anything, the Romans are the ones who are not coming out of this story well at all.
No, I think it's one of the things that I think makes this story really interesting is that it gives us an insight into the brutality of Roman conquest in the Mediterranean and the way that they really don't respect the lives, essentially, of a lot of the people that they're conquering. It's vicious. It really is vicious.
This was success by any means necessary, including, you know, everything from backstabbing to breaking treaties to everything in between.
And one of the things that's been suggested about the massacre that is conducted by Galba is that essentially that was strategy of preventative war. And we do see other horrendous things like that happening, particularly in the conquest of Spain by the Romans. There's other examples where they'll capture the soldiers and then cut off their hands of every man of fighting age and things like that. So there's other massacres as well. It really is. It's a protracted war, as mentioned before. It's like 200 years almost.
So now that their leader is, what is the aftermath? What happens to the Lusitanian resistance?
So the Lusitani regroup, they get a new leader, they attack the Romans again, and they are defeated. And at that point, they make terms with the Romans, and they are then settled on new land as Roman subjects.
So they get what they originally negotiated for after a lot of protracted fighting.
And... Yeah, exactly. They get basically the deal that they had with Galba.
Yeah.
They actually get it.
So this could have been a peace treaty.
If they'd got that in the first place, then the whole thing probably wouldn't have happened.
Yeah. Okay. So did the Romans learn their lesson from this? This seems really costly.
No. There are plenty more Roman adventures to be had in Spain and elsewhere where they enter into these long protracted wars. So one of the consequences of all of this, Roman casualties have been estimated at around 12,000 people across the war with Viriathus, which is a considerable chunk of people. And it's been suggested this was one of the factors that really started to turn people in the second century, or turn Romans in the second century, against the republican system. This was one of those early things where the regular Romans, as opposed to the elite, who were the ones who were being drafted and sent off to fight in these wars, could see that this was being very badly managed in a lot of cases. It wasn't achieving a lot for them personally. And they were starting to get a bit sick of the whole system. So that's something that grows over towards the end of the second century and into the first century, which ultimately leads to the downfall of the Republic.
Yeah.
This has been suggested as, you know, one of those, a very small step, but one of the steps along that journey.
So this is what we're told about Viriathus and the resistance of the Lusitanians. But how does this grow? How does the myth of him get built upon and changed by subsequent generations and retellings?
He becomes something of a legendary figure, first amongst the Romans and then later in Spanish and Portuguese history as well. It really starts pretty early on with a man by the name of Posidonius, and he writes an account of Viriathus, and that account hasn't survived, but we think that is the main source that the sources that we do have are relying on for their information.
Yeah.
So particularly Diodorus Siculus, Cassius Dio seem to be drawing a lot on Posidonius as their source, probably Appian as well. And Posidonius is an interesting figure because he's a Stoic character. He's follows the Stoic philosophy, and he is keen to portray Viriathus as this kind of Stoic example of how a person should be. And so it's thought that that's where a lot of this stuff about Viriathus being untroubled by circumstances, not concerned about worldly possessions, brave, always seeking honor, the great selfless leader, where a lot of these sort of things come from, this portrayal of him by Posidonius.
Mm.
In later times, he continues to have that kind of legendary status. He's one of those many characters in Roman history. Romans seem to quite like this idea of the noble savage who rises up against the Romans and, you know, moves from lowly origins to being a great victor, and purely through the force of being an austere, noble person, those kind of traditional Roman values that they always think that the Romans have lost because they've become soft and weak and all the rest of that.
Yeah, yeah. So you get your Vercingetorix's fighting Caesar, your Boudiccas, I guess, to some extent.
Yeah.
And your vital statistics if you want to go into Asterix comics.
Yeah. So exactly, that kind of model, and he fits very nicely into that. But he also, Viriathus really becomes very important in Spanish and Portuguese nation building as well, particularly when we get up to the 16th century. And he starts to appear in Spanish and Portuguese literature. He becomes this kind of hero who is the savior of his people, the defender of his people. The story moves a bit from him being a member of the Lusitani, trying to, you know, look after the Lusitani and look after himself, to being someone who's trying to free Spain or free Portugal from the Romans.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He never was trying to do, because he seemed quite happy to make peace treaties where he had his bit, as long as. But you get that kind of approach in the 18th century when Spain is occupied by the French forces under Napoleon. Then he becomes again this kind of hero of resistance to foreign oppressors that can be used. Today, he kind of continues to have that status. There are a lot of streets in Spanish and Portuguese cities named Viriathus Street. There's Viriathus Plazas. There's a city in Spain where he has a statue in Zamora. There's a city in Portugal, in Viseu, where he has a statue as well. There's even a type of Portuguese cake that's called a viriato after him. So he continues to have that kind of cultural, you know, memory of being the hero of the people.
That was Christopher Gribben, adjunct lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like the podcast, please subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your readily available podcatching platform. If you feel inclined, leave a review and tell your friends about it. You can like Emperors in Rome on our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Blue Sky, where the podcast is at Rome Podcast. This podcast was recorded at the city campus of La Trobe University in Melbourne, Australia, on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people. So until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.